So maybe you can just start by giving me a little background about your research in the area of gendered violence, or your writing in the area of gendered violence.
So I started writing about gender violence for the first time. I think I had an article published in 2000 in the Stanford Law Journal, and I was really interested in putting together kind of the pieces of masculinity theory with the debate about crime and violence. And at that time, I think what was fresh in everybody's mind was the sodomization of Abner Louima by police officer, I think it was Justin Volpe was his name, in New York City, which is really shocking and brutal. And I got interested in thinking about it as a crime, not just about race, not just about policing, but also about gender and the way that they intersect. So that's how I started thinking about violence as a kind of language that is distinctively attractive, I think, to masculinity or certain kinds of masculinity.
And so how, if we think about the way that that writing and theorizing reflects on issues of violence today, I sent you a question to think a little bit about some of the recent debates about violence and the state responses to violence. Can you say a little bit about this concern that's been raised recently about violence being out of control, and the ways that being a feminist theorist and a critical race theorist reflects on that debate?
Yeah, well, there's so many. The way that I come at it, I think, is not so much as a policy analyst as really kind of a cultural observer, and that's where critical race feminism is important to me, because I think that so much of our gun violence comes out of distinctive cultures or subcultures in our country that are wrapped up very much around in questions of race and gender. So, for example, I think the state, if we think of the government itself as having an interest in national security, in anti-terrorism, in protection from outside threats. We have a presidential candidate who's very much speaking in the language of the necessity of force to protect us from enemies from without. And that's a language that I think is deeply rooted in an old tradition about the state as the kind of patriarchal protector of the people and needing to have control over life and death in order to keep us safe from enemies within and without. And violence is kind of inherently a tool of that kind of vision of security as power and control. And then we also have cultures, and we know that we've got a very strong culture of gun rights in this country as well, kind of a which rallies around the Second Amendment and is very much based, I think, still in a frontier image of what it means to be an American, somebody who's independent, who doesn't need to depend on the state at all, and for that reason needs direct access to the means of self-protection as a form of reliance and a form of political citizenship. And that culture, I think, is also sometimes implicitly, but also steeped in narratives about gender and about race, because you think of who the image of the frontier person is. It's usually a man who's protecting his family against Indians, against maybe uprising slaves, against people who, again, represent threats to the people. And there's been a real upsurgence in white nationalism recently, again, that we see around the Trump campaign in particular, that I think taps deeply into that Second Amendment vision of gun culture as well. And then we have also different kinds of subcultures in urban cities. We know there's a horrible epidemic of black-on-black violence and killings, and that partly is around the sense that urban communities don't feel safe. They don't feel safe from the state, and they don't feel safe against the individuals in their communities who are using guns. I was really influenced by Jill Leovi's recent book, Ghettocide, where she talks about kind of the failure of the police on both ends, right? So there's over-policing in these communities in the sense of stop and frisk, police crackdowns for minor crimes, but there's also under-policing in that the really serious crimes, the homicides, don't get adequate resources for investigation and arrest. And so there's this culture of really feeling like you're on your own, that you've got to protect yourself and that you've got to be strong and that you've got to, if anyone disrespects you, you've got to be prepared to kind of go to the max to defend yourself against that. And so that's another kind of subculture in our country that is very deeply entangled with gun violence. And again, the reasons stretch into race as well as gender. So that's just kind of a sampling of where I see kind of the current landscape and the ways in which we're so connected on all these different levels to guns, to violence as kind of the image of security as well as the image of insecurity.
And in what ways do you think that feminists bring a unique voice to this conversation about issues of violence in communities and state responses to violence? This is a dominant conversation in many spheres, particularly in academia today. And is there a unique feminist voice that can inform that conversation?
Yeah, I think there are a lot of really powerful feminist voices. I mean, the Say Her Name campaign is one of them that's calling attention to female victims of state violence, women of color in particular. But what feminists can do, I think, is to highlight the gender dimension of many of these debates. And one of those gender dimensions has to do with the identity of the people who are both the perpetrators and the victims. So Say Her Name is calling attention to the erasure of women victims of gun violence. But also, as Jackson Katz and other people have pointed out, there's a big silence about the fact that overwhelmingly the perpetrators of gun violence tend to be men. And so there's an identity kind of dimension of that conversation that feminists can call attention to. But more importantly, I think it's feminists can talk about the ways in which it's not just about whether it's men or women who are doing the killing or who are being the victims of crime, but the way in which so much, I think, perpetration of violence and the conversation about violence proceeds on lines that track conventional sorts of masculinities that are about, again, protection, control, and force. And I think there are scripts that follow that are eerily similar if you look at the kind of narrative scripts that police are following and the narrative scripts that suspects are following. Frank Rudy Cooper, another law professor, has written a lot about masculinity contests as a way of characterizing some of these individual confrontations between citizens and the police, where both sides are feeling like, oh, I'm being disrespected, you know, and they ratchet up the confrontation just a little bit more. And if both of the parties have these narratives about aggression and demanding respect, then you're going to have a confrontation that easily is going to boil over into violence. Mm-hmm.
And do you see alternatives to that script or ways in which your work provides alternatives to that dominant script?
I don't know if I, in particular, have answers for undoing that particular script. But one thing that I will say that I think is super interesting is, let's just say it's a solution or it's an answer to some of this violence that is going to be a very long road to hoe. But I'm really fascinated by the way in which the younger generation, I'm talking about kids who are maybe my daughter's age in their teens, many of them are abandoning the script of traditional masculinity in a number of ways. There's an explosion, it seems to me, just anecdotally, and a number of kids who are gender queer, who are trans in various ways, who are abandoning gender altogether, who consider themselves to be agender. And I see that as kind of a loosening of these cultural narratives, or at least it makes available a loosening of the cultural narratives about what it means to be a man, and the insistence that we've had until this point that if you're born with a penis, then there are certain things that you have to do, and there are certain ways that your personality has to be, including this sort of propensity or willingness to use violence and to cut yourself off from alternative means like empathy and conciliation and all of the kind of skills that we attribute to women rather than men. So I think long term there's this really interesting cultural shift, which might not seem like it has anything at all to do with guns or violence, but I think over the long term it could be a way of relaxing our cultural hold on those narratives about what it means to be a man.
Right. And along the lines, kind of coming back to this discussion about the interactions between police and community members and the need sort of to call attention to some of that violence, in what ways do you think that, fresh in my mind is the civil settlement yesterday or 2 days ago where Sandra Bland's family settled that case. In what ways do the relationships between women and the police in these situations where we've had state-imposed violence and sadly death either change the way we think about police control, reaffirm the way we think about police control? And what is the intersection you see there between gender and race in cases such as hers?
That's a really interesting question. I mean, I think in part that interaction and ones like it are shocking to some folks in the public, because again, we have this kind of script where confrontations that end in violence and death are between two men, and here you had a man and a woman, and a woman acting in a way that was not stereotypically submissive. She stood up for her rights and said, right, you know, you can't do this to me. And she ended up paying the ultimate price for it. And so I think it's an interesting confrontation, perhaps, to people who are not used to seeing women stand up for themselves in that kind of way. I don't know whether it would confirm or deny or push back against existing stereotypes about race, because we also have an idea of the black woman as being smart-mouthed and angry and, you know, kind of stepping up. And so maybe in some ways that watching that event was stereotype confirming rather than stereotype challenging. But I think it's really important, at least, to see and to acknowledge that there are women as well as male victims, and that from a race perspective, when we think about Black Lives Matter, we have to remember that Black women lives matter as well.
And to some degree, that it's possible that this violence is a form of, you know, keeping gender norms in line, right? When women step out of those roles, there may be suggestion that the state acts in ways to keep them in those positions.
Yeah, absolutely.
So thinking back to this question of a feminist voice in an area of gun control or gun violence where there are arguably few feminist voices, the narrative is dominantly quite masculine. What do you see as alternatives to the status quo in terms of state responses to violence? Are there other pathways that you think, particularly coming at this issue from the perspective of a critical race feminist, would bring you to?
I think there's really, really interesting work, and a lot of the cutting edge work around feminist thinking and violence, I think, is coming out of the domestic violence movement, the DV movement, because domestic violence is an area where the first wave of feminist reform really focused on enlisting the state to say, hey, domestic violence is a crime, and you police should take it seriously, and you prosecutors should take it seriously. So there was an effort to do things like mandatory arrest laws and other sorts of policies that would make sure that domestic violence was prosecuted to the same level as stranger violence. And then a few years ago, we started to see a real feminist rethinking of that policy and a recognition that that political alliance with the state and trying to make sure that domestic violence would be punished and treated the same way as other crimes was also ratcheting up and inflaming the mass incarceration crisis, and that its enforcement was, again, reinforcing gender and racialized narratives that were ultimately pernicious and that the feminist community was actually trying to stand against. So that created a huge crisis of faith in the feminist community about, okay, what do we do to keep people safe? What does real security look like? And I think a number of really interesting feminist movements have reached out to restorative justice and transformative justice as alternatives. And the challenge is, if you're going to say, as restorative justice and transformative justice do, that we can't rely on the state to be our ultimate protector of security through these traditional narratives of, well, we'll use force and violence against perpetrators, and you want to put the community in a place of better power, and you want to put the habitual victims of violence, especially women and children, in a more empowered place, how do you do that, again, in a culture that is so infused with misogyny? So it's a huge struggle, but I think it's really promising to think about restorative circles, for example, as a way of dealing with conflict that is not about identifying the person who's the perpetrator and punishing them, but really about trying to heal the community, trying to, in some cases, build a community that hasn't been adequately created in the first place, and to bring together the people who are perpetrators, the people or identified perpetrators, the people who are identified victims, and try to go beyond the notion of somebody's going to go to jail for this, somebody's going to be punished, but are the victims really safe at the end of the day? Another really interesting initiative that I've had some contact with is through jails and prisons. There are a number of programs now that try to enlist offenders in the work of understanding, these are predominantly men, of understanding how they came to rely so much on violence. And so there's a program called Resolve to Stop the Violence has that mission, and there's others that I've heard about as well. And there it really is about educating offenders about masculinity and about trying to expand the toolkit of self-defense, the toolkit of maintaining dignity and self-respect beyond the notion, if somebody disrespects me, then I'm going to use violence. But really understanding where those narratives came from about what it means to be a man and how restricted they are, but that it doesn't have to be that way. So I see all of those as really hopeful and feminist-infused techniques of moving beyond kind of the knee-jerk, you know, if you have a problem, get a gun.
Mm-hmm. And so this is a fascinating look at the ways that communities can help roll back violence and disrupt that sort of hyper-masculine script of guns being a solution to disrespect or, you know, needing to sort of rise up to protect oneself. I guess the question is, you know, that's a, when we think about violence that relates to violence between communities and the police, you need both sides to roll that script back. And do you see ways or promising avenues in which to have those same types of rollbacks within the community of law enforcement? Mm-hmm. Or are we so wedded to the notion that we have a single tool for the control of community violence?
Yeah. Well, it's really interesting. There was an op-ed in the New York Times today by William Bratton where he talks about, you know, his legacy, and he's trying to distance himself now from the zero tolerance, broken windows policing that ran under his name for so long and that contributed so much to mass incarceration and to this just widespread criminalization of African American communities. And so I think there's a way in which the crisis of violence by the state against communities of color and the response in Black Lives Matter and allied uprisings to really protest and push back against that has created a moment of opportunity where I'm not sure, of course, whether it's going to happen or not because everything is so contingent, but it's an opening at least to rethink what we're doing with our policing and to go back to ideas like having police on the street, having there be a beat, sort of traditional notions of community policing that involved real relationship building between police officers and communities so that these encounters aren't coming in the context of fear, distrust, and suspicion on both sides, on the police side and on the community side. I've never understood why policing isn't considered part of social work, because that's what it is. And people who are police officers should be trained in, not just in sort of nonviolent resolution of crises, but really should be trained around issues of mental health and mental illness, and should be deeply part of the community, and should be about trying to support the family and community networks that, that are there in the first instance, should be kind of the basis of security, right? We shouldn't be looking to the state and state violence as the first line of community security. That should be way down the road when other forms of security have failed. And police really, I think, need to be embedded in those networks of care and protection in order for people to be really safe.
Right, and we know that when you have a dominantly male police force, the notions of de-escalation and relationship building are not front and center. As women enter policing, we see more of that, but women have remained a very small proportion of police forces nationwide for 30 or 40 years. So maybe a long ways away from that.
The institution of policing is the same too, right? Yeah. Policing is still organized in hierarchical lines the way the military is.
Exactly.
And you have all of these things that trappings of a very, very old kind of patriarchal militaristic way of doing an institution. And so just dropping some individual women police officers into an institution like that is going to be problematic if you're going to expect change out of that.
Right, exactly.
So, yeah, I agree. It's really a long-term project to try to remake the police, but I think that's the, you know, if you're looking at what feminism would say about that, I think that that's the way that a feminist would look at redoing policing.
Right. So maybe one final question, because I want to keep us to our half an hour. So when we have events that are particularly high profile, where there's a mass shooting or there's a major concern about gun violence, the call is often for increased gun control, right? And the debate centers on what states can do through gun control measures to prevent violence. Where do you think that strategy, do you think that's an effective strategy? And if so, we may be at the limit. I'm from Massachusetts, a state that has tremendous gun control. We still have a lot of gun violence. What are the limits of that strategy of gun control as the mechanism to reduce gun violence?
Yeah, well, I think we've really seen, and we've seen the frustration on the face of President Obama every time there's another mass shooting and he has to go to the community and say, well, it's too bad we can't get any gun laws passed. So but I think I agree with you that we're really seeing the limits of gun control as the primary strategy, because it runs up again against a culture that is very strongly protective of guns. And I'm now thinking back to that Second Amendment NRA culture. So there's got to be a way to get beyond, to get to safety that's not going to just run straight into that buzzsaw of political dysfunction. And I think, again, maybe one way to think about it is this long-term cultural battle to loosen the bonds or to examine masculinity and why it is that getting a gun is the best way to protect yourself, or we think of getting a gun as the best way to protect yourself. So I've become, you know, I was, for a while, I was one of those people who thought, okay, well, the next mass shooting, this is going to be the point where we all say, wait, this is crazy, we can't stop doing this. But that doesn't seem to happen. I think it, you know, each tragedy just creates doubling down on both sides. Mm,
right,
so
right.
rather than focusing kind of on the tool of are there guns available, or are there not guns available, or what do gun control laws look like, again, I think the feminist way forward is through these growing these alternative ways of dispute resolution, conflict resolution, having restorative justice programs in our schools, as well as diversions from the criminal justice system. So you're really giving people from a very early age the tools to think about conflict, to deal with conflict in ways that don't involve violence, as well as this very long-term game about, really breaking down some of the traditional gender narratives that we have, and expanding what it means to be a man, as well as expanding what it means to be a woman. And as I said, I really think that this is already starting to happen among a lot of younger kids, that they're questioning the notion of, well, to be a man means that you don't cry, that you don't have emotions, that, you know, this, that, and the other. So
unpacking gender norms may in fact be a solution or a way forward. And
I think so. I think it's a really long-term solution. It's not as satisfying as passing
right.
saying, okay, now we're safe. But I think in the long term, it's really going to be the most enduring legacy. Mm-hmm.